From the University at Buffalo School of Social Work, welcome to the In Social Work podcast. I'm Peter Sabota. It's good to have you along, everybody. The concept of neurodiversity recognizes and values natural differences in human brain function. This term covers conditions such as autism, ADHD, and obsessive-compulsive disorder, and it's been highlighted in recent educational, medical, political, and social discussions. Given the prevalence and increased identification of these differences, social workers and social work educators would be well served to learn about and understand how neurodiversity impacts clients, colleagues, and social work students in higher education. On today's show, our guest, Dr. Jennifer Greenfield, will describe what neurodiversity is, how those affected cope and succeed, and how knowledge and awareness of neurodiversity can be utilized by social workers and social work educators to support diverse clients and students in the settings in which we interact with them. Dr. Greenfield will argue that for social work professionals, understanding neurodiversity is essential to providing effective and inclusive support for people with varied neurological profiles. And she'll conclude by discussing the impact of current federal policy changes on this population. Jennifer Greenfield, PhD, is Associate Professor at the University of Denver Graduate School of Social Work and the Noble Institute for Healthy Aging. Hi, Jen. Welcome to In Social Work.
Good to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, no, our pleasure. Thanks very much. So if we could, and especially for me, could we begin very simply? I don't want to assume anything. When we say the word neurodivergent or use neurodivergence to, you know, talk about a person, What exactly are we talking about?
So it's funny that you say that simple, because it's not at all, right?
I figured.
The word itself is pretty complicated. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to step back and talk first about the word neurodiverse or neurodiversity,
sure.
Which is basically the principle that people are different, right? Which we all know, but that our brains are different. And so we all have different types of brain wiring, different, you know, tendencies that form our, you know, how we respond in social situations, how we perform cognitively, and so on. And so the principle is that there is neurodiversity in the world. There are some kinds of brain structures that are more typical than others. And so, you know, neuroscientists will often do brain scans and, you know, the majority of people have a brain that looks a certain way, right?
Yeah.
Or brain components that interact with one another in a certain way. And so then there's another percentage of the population, you know, I've seen some estimates around 20% or so of brains are different. But how they're different is there's diversity in that, right? And so neurodivergence, in its most basic form, is really just referring to those brains that are in that 20% rather than the 80%. And so the 80% is often referred to as neurotypical, and then the 20% would be referred to often as neurodivergent. Now, neurodivergence.
Even the language is interesting here, isn't it?
It's tough, right? Because divergent, for some people, has some, you know, negative connotations. It can come with some stigma and so on. And so there is a movement among some to kind of reclaim some of this language or to use different language. One of my favorites is neurospicy, which, you know, that implies that 80% maybe is neurobland. I don't know. But
yeah.
At any rate, you know, to really think of it as a way that some folks are different, and that they process information differently, that they interact with others differently, and maybe, you know, generate thought in different and interesting ways. And with that, then, because of those differences, if we think about activities like education, which is specifically designed to engage us cognitively as well as socially, there are ways in which that neurodivergence then plays out in those educational contexts that I think is important and under examined.
Yes. And that's something that we had you and I had planned to talk about it, and we will do that later. Thank you. Yeah, it's really interesting because, at least for me, kind of even the word disability strikes me as kind of like a socially constructed word, right? And I think that would apply to neurodiverse or whatever, neurotypical. So I think part of what I'm curious about, and I'm sure we're going to get to this, is how we can kind of reauthor that cultural narrative about what it means to be neurodiverse. Because as you were describing some of the distinguishing features, my reaction, quite frankly, was those are desirable qualities.
Absolutely. And, I think there is a whole conversation ongoing right now about balancing our understanding of neurodivergence, because among some, there's a tendency to maybe over-romanticize and say, oh, it's superpower, or, like it's all these great things. And yes, and there are also ways in which it can, these things can really become challenging in certain contexts. And as you say, a lot of this is really socially constructed. I have to brag. One of my kids, I am neurodivergent. My children are neurodivergent. It's often quite genetic. But one of my kids left school one day. At age 10, feeling really frustrated with an encounter that he had had. And he said a quote that has really stuck with me, which is, I don't have a learning disability. I learn really well. And that's true, he does. What he said he said, I have a school disability.
Ooh,
And I think that
10
that's
years old.
really profound, right? That for a lot of folks, it's a work disability or a school it's the context that makes being neurodivergent difficult, right?
And as a couple of social workers, the person in environment people, right? This should be right up our alley. And I hope we could get to that later. Wonderful. It's interesting. Yeah, I'm having a bunch of ideas just even talking with you about the playing field here. But I spent about 6 years on the school board in my kind of rural community. So this is a relatively small school where, everybody knows everybody. We would have a lot of conversations about special education. There were, of course, lots of resources dedicated to that. Parents were not always happy with those and advocated for their children, which is, of course, what I would do. But what was very interesting at the same time, and again, not to over-romanticize, it seemed weird to me that we spent so much time and money talking about, quote, I'm doing air quotes on a podcast, on neurodivergence. But we didn't talk a lot. We didn't have programs for so-called, air quotes again, gifted children.
I mean, we could do a whole separate podcast on this alone. I continue to be quite frustrated at the lack of awareness of what we call twice exceptional kids, adults, etc. So folks who have some kind of identified neurodivergence, learning disability, so on, and also are identified as gifted. And there are many who argue that giftedness actually falls under the umbrella of neurodivergence. And there is research that indicates that brain structures among people who are gifted are different than the brain structures among the neurotypical. And some of the challenges, some of the characteristics, let me say, of neurodivergence. It's quite common, for instance, for there to be sensory processing differences. That is also common with giftedness, and it's related to brain structure and how much information is being taken in and how much needs to be processed all at once. Gifted brain structures tend to be more complex, have more connections across the different parts of the brain. And so, if you can imagine that can lead to sensory overwhelm quite quickly if all of the synapses are firing at once, processing everything in the environment all at once. That can be really challenging. And the way that that can often express itself is through when there's cognitive testing done, they will often be identified as having slow processing speed, which it may be a reflection of how long it takes to pull the one thought that's relevant to the question you got asked when all the other ones are happening all at once. Mm-hmm. And you can see how that might be a problem, not just for gifted folks, but also for folks with ADHD who may have a similar challenge in kind of filtering out the one relevant sentence from all the others that may be flying around in their head. Yeah. And so there are a lot of overlaps between giftedness, ADHD, autism, sometimes OCD. And so I think that this twice exceptional category is, first of all, very underdiagnosed.
Yep.
And then secondly, our systems, especially our educational and K-12 systems, are set up in a way that really compartmentalizes people into one or the other. And I will give as an example that one of my kids, the same one who had that quote earlier, was told that he shouldn't take a foreign language in middle school because he has learning disabilities, even though he's also identified as gifted. And having ADHD means that having challenging subject matter is really important to keeping a student engaged, right? And so for students who have ADHD and giftedness, even though they may have a slow processing speed, it may be really important to get them into the more challenging educational experiences so that they can stay engaged in the class instead of getting bored and zoning out or hopping around or whatever. So this idea that you either can engage in courses for gifted folks or you can receive like supports for a learning difference, it's a really, really harmful kind of dichotomy that many of our school systems kind of impose on our kids. And as a result, students either pursue a kind of gifted track and then are thought of as gifted, or they pursue the track that gets them like in class sports and, you know, those kinds of things. And so by high school, we see this, you know, divergence of that. There are very few people who are identified as 2E, and instead you have your special ed kids and you have your gifted kids, and they're seen as different.
Yeah. Wow.
It's problematic.
You're right. There is a podcast there. I spent a long time believing that, you know, kind of as per Dewey, that education was the great equalizer in society. And I was disappointed, to say the least, and I know I'm not alone. Okay, that's another podcast someday, sort of, Jennifer. Yeah. So, can you talk a little bit, if it's even possible, again in a very broad way, about the social emotional impacts or features, not impacts, but features, perhaps, of a broad definition of neurodivergence? What are the challenges at the social level?
So, you know, it's impossible to give like one defining step, right? And many definitions of neurodivergence include things like, as I've mentioned already, autism, ADHD, OCD, specific learning disorders such as dysgraphia or dyslexia, dyspraxia, et cetera. But then also things like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, and a whole cluster of anxiety disorders are often put into that category as well. And there's research that shows that brain structures for some folks with those diagnoses are different than that neurotypical category. I get air quotes, neurotypical. Mm-hmm. So in terms of, if you think about the social, the ways that those diagnoses show up socially, between depression and ADHD, they may look, you know, absurdly different, right? Depression, a person may, you know, retreat inward, may not want to engage socially, may have a kind of down affect when they are out in social circumstances, right? But with ADHD, it could be with some folks that they're super bubbly and enthusiastic and they've got a ton of energy and that they're like all over the room. And so you might not think of those two things as being related, right? On the other hand, folks with ADHD have a higher tendency to experience depression and anxiety. And so there are times when those things may overlap, right? And in both major depression and in ADHD, just using those as examples, neurotransmitters are implicated, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, and so on. And so there are actually some underlying kind of chemical similarities, even though they express themselves quite differently. One of the things that can be difficult with some of these diagnoses is that there can be challenges with emotional regulation, and the amygdala is the brain structure that is, you know, most commonly associated with these things. And in many scans of folks with ADHD, autism, major depression, a lot of these things, a smaller amygdala volume is detected. And so, and even in giftedness, sometimes that is true as well. Mm-hmm. And it is thought that with giftedness, a lot of the information processing actually occurs through the emotional processing features of the brain. And so that kind of overstressing the amygdala and then sometimes having a smaller volume of amygdala, even as it's being overstressed, can then cause folks to be impulsive, sometimes to react very strongly to stimuli that a neurotypical brain wouldn't react as strongly to. One of the things that I learned about ADHD that I find really fascinating and I've really recognized in both myself and in many of my students is something called rejection sensitivity dysphoria, which is a tendency to take any kind of hint of like negative feedback, even a perceived, you know, somebody rolls their eyes, you think it's about you, and then suddenly you spiral out thinking, oh my God, that person hates me. Maybe it's like, oh, the whole faculty, you know, that kind of super easy to do in a faculty meeting, right?
Exactly. Yes. Oh, geez. Oh, God.
So, yeah. But that it actually has, it has a home in the brain. There's a reason that that occurs. And in many folks who are neurodivergent, it is a form of trauma response. Even though the stimulus that triggered it is not something that a neurotypical person would identify as like, oh my gosh, that person just experienced trauma. For the person with autism or ADHD or major depression or these kinds of things, it may have been the same for them that it was trauma, and then their brain is busy processing it that way. And so if you think about what that would look like in a normal classroom setting or a busy, you know, train platform or, you know, all the different like social settings you might find yourself in, that can make just being out in the world quite exhausting and can cause folks sometimes to react in ways that a neurotypical world would not expect.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And, you know, I'll kind of come clean here. Part of what was behind my original question was an experience I had quite a long time ago with one of my neighbors. One of my neighbors is neurodivergent, and, you know, I've known her since she was born. And we used to go to the playground in my neighborhood with, I have two boys. And there would be kids like on this jungle gym thing, all these various, I'm sure people are familiar with these. And I was just watching her, and she's absolutely adorable. She was playing and running around like everybody else. And then I would watch her engage in proximity with another child who maybe she didn't know. And what was absolutely heartbreaking is half the time I would watch that child slowly figure out a way to get away from her.
Right.
And I mean, that just speaks to, I think, a lot of the things you just said. But those are your early life experiences. And it's heartbreaking, I think, to this day.
Yeah, and those early experiences can lead some, not everybody, but some folks to learn and adapt quite quickly and engage in what is called masking. And so, especially folks with autism, but also with ADHD, can begin to learn the social norms. And it really is, studying it like it's a textbook, but out in the playground or in the classroom. And sometimes it shows up as like mirroring the behaviors that they see around them, repeating the jokes that they, see on TikTok or, whatever, because it got a laugh. And so then it's funny. And so then repeating it. But sometimes, it's figuring out, well, what did I say that made that kid go away last time? And then I'm never going to say that again. Right. And just kind of keeping a catalog of the things that didn't work and then doing something different next time, which again, if you think about it, that's an exhausting way to have,
Yeah.
right?
And it also puts the burden of self-reflection and change on only one person. It's just, all right. Well, thank you for that, like, primer. I think that's a great place to maybe move into what we had kind of planned to talk about a little more specifically. And that is, given the prevalence of neurodiversity in the general population, I think we have to assume, and I just know this because students tell me routinely, we have to, I think, acknowledge that neurodivergent folks will be showing up
Yes.
in schools of social work, whether it's a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral program, quite frankly. And in some ways, it would make perfect sense they would show up
That's
in
right.
those settings. For I'm probably stealing your thunder there. So let's focus there for a bit. Just my first question would be, in your opinion, or you want to combine that with the literature as well, of course, do that. How well, or not so well, does social work education accommodated neurodivergent students? I know I have some opinions about this, but I'm dying to hear yours.
Well, and let me pause and be diplomatic, right? So the first thing I will say, and as you mentioned, I do think that social work is a field that is attractive and well suited to some folks who are neurodivergent. And we know that, for instance, fields like emergency medicine, firefighting, those kind of first responder types of fields tend to draw folks who have ADHD. And social work, I think, is no different in that. I have ADHD. I know that I'm the person who's good in a crisis, right? Because that's when my brain suddenly starts to work. I get flooded with dopamine and I am ready to go. It's all the rest of the time that's not an emergency that maybe I experience some challenges, right? And so in a setting where everything's an emergency, then there it's a place where somebody whose brain really responds well to crisis, to quick deadlines, to variety, those sorts of things, that's where an ADHD brain will flourish, right? Conversely, if you think about, for instance, autism, where else other than academia can you do a deep dive into your passion area, learn everything there is to know about it? The more you learn, the more praise you get, and you get invited to go talk about it
Yeah.
in a room
Just
full of
like the real
people who aren't going
world.
to roll their eyes, right? So it's like perfect for folks who love to do the deep dive, right? And whether it's ADHD or autism, that's one of the predominant characteristics. And so it seems like, academia would be a great place, right? And there are sometimes behaviors, tendencies, needs that are not well accommodated in higher ed and particularly in social work. And so differences in communication styles, for instance, is one where some folks who are neurodivergent have a tendency to speak very directly, maybe sometimes without like, you know, a layer of diplomacy that we are socialized into in academia. I just used it. Can also speak impulsively. And so if you think about the students in the classroom who answer every question or who interrupt when you're in the middle of talking about something to give their example, or who maybe take you off on a tangent that isn't where you wanted to go, and then you have to reel them back in order to get back to what you were talking about. I know that as instructors, we've all had situations like that. And I've even had situations where a faculty member has come to me and said, I've got a real problem. This student is so aggressive in my classroom. They just won't stop. They keep, you know, peppering me with questions, or every time I ask a question, they insist on answering it. And so it's framed as a problem, as like negative behavior, as something that needs to be corrected, right? And I've seen it happen where that student in the classroom starts to speak by like week three, and everybody else in the room starts to roll their eyes. They start to play with the paper. They shift in their seat. They're giving all of these nonverbal social cues to this person saying, please stop talking, right? And the person who is neurodivergent, who's talking a lot, does not receive those nonverbal cues. And then that miscommunication, there's an attempt to communicate that's not received, then stirs up anger. And so the other people are like, this person is insisting, even though we've told them, air quotes, we've told them not to, and the only communication was nonverbal, then it's not received. And so then that person is the one who is aggressive, you know, intentional in offending people, et cetera.
Yeah, challenging, right?
That's it. I see this in classrooms all the time.
Me too. Yeah,
so
I agree.
Thinking about ways to reframe that first, you know, as the faculty member in charge of the room, thinking about that student differently, then prompting others to use verbal communication instead of nonverbals, thinking about ways to channel that student's enthusiasm and often deep knowledge, right, into ways that can be helpful in the classroom. Those are all things that the faculty member and then other people in the classroom should spend energy on instead of problematizing the one person and, you know, forcing them to leave the classroom wondering why everyone hates them, you know? So that's one thing, you know, with ADHD, I know we often will also, I have, you know, colleagues who complain all the time about students who miss assignments, who only, you know, do half the assignment and then the whole other half is missing, who ghost them, right? They just stop communicating because they missed an assignment and now all of a sudden they don't answer emails. I've been that student, okay? I know that student really well. And there are reasons that these things occur that have roots in often in neurodivergence, but also roots in the fact that the neurodivergence was highly masked and wasn't caught until the student reached a point where the coping skills they had developed no longer work or don't work as well. And it could be as an undergrad, the just the volume
the
of
freedom
work that's required kind of makes everything spin out. I've seen it happen in a doctoral program where they make it all the way through and then they get into a PhD program. And I've had neurodivergent students tell me all of the strategies that they had used to get through everything up through their master's no longer worked in a PhD program. And if you think about it, the way we've structured PhD programs is completely different than everything that students have done before. And we don't do much, if anything, to prepare students for the different ways they need to work.
And in a beautiful case scenario, we have supported neurodivergent students all along. You know, we've given them structure, we've made courses accessible. I laugh that, in the, I think now 30 years that I've been teaching, it's syllabus are now like mini books now, because
Yes,
we
they
have
are. They're
authors.
novels.
Like I've seen 18 and 19 page syllabus. So, and but you know, and that's not all bad. Some of it's, I think, a little weird, but some of it is really helpful. But then you get into a doctoral program where you're now expected to take all sorts of initiative, right? And it's such a stark change.
Right.
It's almost like a setup.
Yep, it really does feel like a setup. And the more I've thought about it, the more I realize this is unbelievable, really, what we do. We really set students up to fail. And it's not just neurodivergent students. I think it's a shock to the system for anybody, right? But in particular for students with neurodivergence, like I think that, we really are setting them up, if not to fail, to at least struggle and burn out. Very, and so burnout rates are high. And so, another thing is that it is really difficult, even in those programs you said, like in an ideal setting, we've, structured everything, we've provided all these supports. But there's even, I just read an article recently that was published last year. It was from the field of occupational therapy, but it was talking about how the framework of universal design for learning isn't completely helpful. And they surveyed neurodivergent students in particular and asked about the several different like implementations of universal design for learning and discovered that several of them are harmful, not helpful, right? And if you think about it, somebody with autism may really need a lot of structure and specificity. They may need to know exactly like what topic to write on, or if not what topic, have clearly defined kind of categories to help them choose a really well-structured rubric so that they understand what's being assessed. All of that. And I think our field has moved a lot toward using rubrics and that kind of thing, which can a well-done rubric can be really helpful. Most of them aren't well done, but a well-done one can be helpful. But with somebody with ADHD who really needs to have variety and choice, that level of specificity can feel like overwhelming in terms of its rigidity, and doesn't give them room to thrive in doing the spirit of the assignment, if not following the letter of the assignment, right? And so it's really difficult to design things in a classroom setting that work really well for all of the different neurotypes. So I think we as faculty are kind of set up to fail too, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's the nature of. I was kind of thinking while you were talking, I was thinking about, broadly speaking, social work education, and even our profession, and we're a reflection of the overall society, which is, I mean, let's talk about so I'll let me talk about social work for a second. We're This is kind of one of my lover's quarrels with the profession that I'm proud to be a member of. But we're kind of our history is kind of ableist. Not kind of, it pretty ableist. You just got finished making the point. And we've even had a role historically in the eugenic movement. I mean, for God's sake. So I mean, there is lots of room for that kind of self-reflection. And I think I may be oversimplifying it. I don't have the expertise that you do, but adaptations and viewpoints and structural changes that would benefit neurodivergent students would benefit all students. It's not like we're doing anything, completely benevolent. It
That's right.
would help everybody in
Right.
many ways.
I will use as an example, to make a course accessible to students with, for instance, like a visual disability, we should have all of our documents, in our learning management system, Canvas or whatever. All of those saved in a way that is accessible for the text reading apps, right? Mm-hmm. So whether it's a PDF or a website or whatever it is, you know, a video with caption, like it all needs to be accessible for those like screen reader things, mm-hmm. right? Well, having done that in courses, I've had students who have a long commute who say, thank you so much, because they can have their articles that they need to read read to them while they drive in, mm-hmm. you know, Denver traffic to get to their destinations. You know, students who are in internships who have to drive all over the town or whatever, you know, that they can use that in their car. So a lot of the things that we implement, you know, with a universal design for learning framework, the whole point is that they're universally beneficial, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I see sometimes some resistance to implementing the changes that are needed. Sometimes, you know, because they are time consuming, we as faculty mm-hmm. are
sure.
seriously overstressed in terms of how much work we have to get done. And so taking the time to like redo all the PDFs, put captions and transcripts in for videos, et cetera, mm-hmm. can be challenging. But if we think about the fact that it's not for one student, you know, and that it's going to facilitate success for many of our students across many years, right? Then I think that the value of that time increases. And so I know that I've become more willing to do those things as I've learned how beneficial it can be for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah. And I will not claim to be, you know, great at this. I've learned over the years, and am still learning. I had a blind student in an online course, and I didn't know it until about 2 or 3 weeks before the course began. Mm-hmm. And it was a major heavy lift. And I'd be lying if I said I found it time consuming and frustrating, but that's my and our fault, right? Mm-hmm. It's not. But so pretty much I had to do everything mm-hmm. To make the proper accommodations. The student taught me mm-hmm. how to do it better, which again goes back to that point of your point earlier about, you know, we've implemented this stuff and the neurodivergent students give us feedback. It never occurs to us, rarely at least, to ask them before we develop them, because they have the expertise. This student taught me a ton of things. And the, I guess, neurotypical students in the course loved the changes that were made.
Yep.
And so there's your real life example of just how this works, but some of the real obstacles in the environment that we find ourselves. So you've covered some of the obstacles that are inherent and in place already. And you've kind of touched, I think, on what social work education would look like if it was evaluated and implemented through a neurodivergent lens. But would you like to say more about that? I guess my question is, besides what you've already said, are there other ways that, you know, if we put on a lens that would inform everything we see, how would things look? Mm-hmm. How would they be different?
Well, like I said, I think that it's difficult to identify any one size fits all changes.
Right.
But one thing that I have learned is that starting each class with curiosity is an essential first step. Not assume who's in the room with you, and instead ask, right? And so instead of saying, oh, I think my students are all going to really benefit from having a lot of choice in all of the assignments that they do, without realizing that for some percentage of students, that's actually going to increase their anxiety, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, for some, it will be really a beautiful thing. Yeah, you know, So ask, right? You know, do a little survey at the beginning of the quarter, get to know you kind of thing, and ask, you know, do you benefit from, you know, being able to choose different modes of communicating when completing an assignment? Do you prefer group work, or do you prefer to work, you know, by yourself? You know, those kinds of questions, I think, can really help you to understand who's in the room. And you may have some students, for instance, for whom fluorescent lights trigger migraines, right? But other students who really feel the need to have bright light. And it may be difficult to accommodate both needs, but it's important to know that you have both needs in the room so that if there are times when you can have the lights off, that's going to help the students who need it off, but you'll know that it may be increasing anxiety for others. If you need to have the lights on all the time, know that some folks may have to step away because the lights are triggering migraines. And so you'll understand why students are leaving. And maybe you can provide alternative ways for them to consume some of the content so that they don't have to sit under fluorescent lights for 3 hours, right? So it's things like that. Direct communication is one where I think that we all could benefit. And it's so ironic that in social work,
that's why I'm laughing.
But delivering, you know, critical feedback in a way that's direct and kind,
compassion,
requires, you know, skill and nuance, but it, I think, is a bare minimum that we should be able to ask of instructors, right? We have to be willing to tell students when their work is not meeting expectations. And we have to be willing to deliver that information in a way that is kind, isn't going to like trigger, you know, a downward spiral and they're suddenly going to disappear, but also is, and I'm going to use, you know, my favorite social work word, operationalizable, right? That, you know, instead of saying, well, the grammar in this is terrible, help them understand which parts of the grammar could really use some work and direct them to a resource to get assistance with that, right? You know, I had a student that I worked with a few years ago who loved to use semicolons in places where maybe a semicolon didn't belong. Well, say that, you know, let's review commas and semicolons. You know, it, this is something that many people get wrong. There's nothing wrong with for needing a refresher on it. Let's talk about it. And then, you know, in the process, you may learn that the person grew up in a household where English wasn't the language spoken at home, or, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. And so don't bring assumptions into the conversation, including don't assume that a student isn't willing to receive the feedback, right? So I think having some clear communication, I always start a class by saying, I tend to be very direct in my communication and I never mean to be unkind. If you ever receive something and you're worried that, you know, I'm thinking badly about you because of the way I delivered my feedback, just tell me, because I've been there and I've been the student who spiraled out of control because I thought my professor hated me. Right. And so just sort of naming and normalizing these things happen.
And modeling it. I mean, I've learned my lesson. You know, I have tried to do many, I've have implemented many of the things that you've suggested, but not after not doing that for quite a while. I mean, I've had to chase, fortunately this was a while ago, I've had to stop my class to follow a student who has left the room because I was worried about their welfare.
Right.
And now when a student gets up, we have an understanding and they are more apt to communicate on their way out. They'll just turn to me and say, I got this up right.
Right.
And it just is so much easier. If you just give people the opportunities to kind of normalize, I guess, I'm not sure that's the greatest word, but normalize the unique needs that students have. So, you know, while you were talking, we were focusing on students, but as you've made very clear, those of us who are on faculties or interacting with faculty and staff, we're working with neurodivergent folks too.
Yes.
So I also wondered to what degree neurodivergence gets played out in faculty relationships and interactions, and is not helpful. Let's
Yes.
put it that way. Lack of knowledge. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that, but that was a thought that I had while you were talking, because I'm, going through the Rolodex in my head of all the mistakes that I have made.
I think that it's really important and that it is something we should be talking about more. We know that historically, ADHD, autism, OCD, a lot of these things have been significantly underdiagnosed, underassessed. We are now seeing rapid increases in diagnoses among adults. It is only with this last version of the DSM that it was possible to have a diagnosis of autism and ADHD. It used to be you could only have one.
Right.
And so we are suddenly seeing assessments and clinical understandings catch up to maybe better reflect the human experience, though certainly not.
Even though it was right in front of us for decades, you mean?
The other thing is that we are now understanding more about kind of the hormonal roots of some of the challenges that come. And so, for instance, a thing that doesn't get talked about a lot is that perimenopause is a time when ADHD symptoms show up in ways that they hadn't before. And so we now see a phenomenon where people of a certain age experiencing hormonal changes may suddenly seem to be falling apart. Like all of a sudden they're not, as organized as they used to be, or they're having trouble finding the word in a faculty meeting, or, things like that. And that may very well be related to some underlying, variations in neurotransmitters that's occurring. And so that's leading to more diagnoses, but it's also, I think, a lot of people haven't even heard about it yet. And so they may be unaware that this is what's going on. So I think I have noticed that in higher ed among faculty, that there is a tendency to do what I described earlier that we do with students, which is to sort of assign negative intent to behaviors that we deem as diverging from the norm, instead of seeing like, that person communicates really directly. I wonder what that's about, right? Or that person like interrupts a lot in faculty meetings. I wonder what's going on there. One of the things that I haven't mentioned yet that's that's common with autism, ADHD, and giftedness is justice sensitivity. And so that's another reason you may find a lot of neurodivergence in social work. We're like social justice advocates, right? That's what we're supposed to be. But you see folks sometimes in the field of social work who are focused on a justice issue almost to the exclusion of everything else, right? And they are talking about it ad nauseum and are really critical of, what's happening elsewhere, like, we're all living in this time of cognitive dissonance, right? Like, our democracy is falling apart, right? The world is like literally on fire, and I still have to figure out what to cook for dinner, right? And somehow, as a social worker, as a human who cares about the world, I have to make an ethical choice about where to purchase the ingredients for the dinner with kids who are super particular about what they're going to eat, right?
Yeah.
Often like brand specific about what food choices they make. And so living in a world like that, where justice is driving most of our actions, can in and of itself be exhausting and also infuriating, right? And can lead to a sense of like, I don't, you know, I don't feel like I can take any action, or can lead to a sense that I must take action always. So I see sometimes people who engage in constant doom scrolling, right? We know from the research that social media can trigger dopamine hits, right? There's an instant gratification. And so folks with ADHD have a tendency to really lean on social media and, like, you know, their phones and stuff. And then if they've got this justice sensitivity and they're really focused on the injustices in the world, it can be a preoccupying thing that really makes it difficult to get to the business of the school, right? Or the business of the home. And so these are challenges, I think, in the field of social work that often go unnamed. And we often don't link these behaviors with underlying neurodivergence. And instead we think about, like, oh, that's the faculty member who always talks about XYZ, and maybe not realizing, like, oh, that may be an expression of the trauma that they're experiencing because there's this injustice that's making their amygdala go nuts, you know?
Yeah. It's amazing that you said that, because as I've been listening to you speak, I was thinking about this kind of sensitivity that you're talking about, or acknowledgement, is really, there are many, many parallels to a trauma-informed perspective. Mm-hmm. So we're not reinventing the wheel here in many right. ways by asking people to be accommodating and acknowledging. So we're kind of bumping up against our time. And I don't want to miss this opportunity for you and I to end up on a list if we're not on one already. And speaking of exhausting and infuriating, are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. What would be your take, if you accept the challenge, to talk about how the Trump administration policies have impacted neurodivergent folks?
One thing that must be said immediately is I worried about even coming on the podcast and
I understand
naming that I am neurodivergent, because that does potentially literally put me on a list, right? You mentioned eugenics earlier, and there is a lot of fear that the registry that this administration has proposed making and may actually be trying to make by reaching out to pharmaceutical companies or pharmacies, you know, medical practices, so on, to you know, get lists of people who take certain medications that are sometimes useful. So if that list is being compiled, or if it's about to be, what do they then do with it? Does it mean that folks with certain diagnoses don't get access to medical care, or can't access student loans, or, you know, like, what does it mean? Right. So that's one thing that I worry about.
They're dismantling the Department of Education.
Right.
They're the funders of special ed.
And not just the funders, but also the enforcers, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, in being a parent of kids who are in K-12 public schools, they have certain rights and protections that sometimes get violated. And what is my recourse, right? I've literally had to think about, if I were to pursue some kind of complaint. I live in the state of Colorado, where I feel fairly confident that our state administration would uphold, you know, requirements. But if it got to the federal level, would there be any enforcement of, you know, the 504, you know, requirements? I don't know.
Absolutely.
So, and if there is some kind of, like, rollback or dismantling of those supports for neurodivergent kids, then what does that mean for the undergrads that we'll get, you know, in 10 or 15 years, right? will they have gone through an educational system where their needs aren't met? Will they essentially be gatekept? Like, will we not see as many students because they didn't get the supports they needed as young kids? And so they don't have the GPA in high school to get into the schools, you know, that those sorts of things.
It's like peeling open an onion of just impact after impact. Yeah. One of the things that I've been thinking about is if, and I could have this wrong, if I do, please correct me, but if the Department of Education and the services they've historically provided are going to get dismantled, or more likely subsumed under Health and Human Services, my fear is under Health and Human Services, the response is going to be medication.
Right.
Not accommodation, differentiation, and understanding.
Well, and it can go both ways too, because then I've also seen people who say that, for instance, like Ritalin and Adderall are overprescribed, and, you know, that, I mean, they're controlled substances because there's this terrible fear that,
right,
you know, they're being, and I do think, you know, they sometimes get abused and misused. There is,
of course,
the joke though, that for folks who genuinely have ADHD, remembering to take the pills, getting the new prescription, picking it up, all of those are executive function challenges that, you know, really demonstrate that it's not addictive. Can't remember, mm-hmm. don't pick it up. Is, you know, are there going to be shortages or inability to get those prescriptions, mm-hmm. which for some people are life-changing and even life-saving medicines, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. And if you just try to medicate the behaviors without providing the other supports, it really is missing the mark, because so much of the stuff, so many of the reasons that neurodivergent folks run up against barriers in our social systems, in education, workplaces, and so on, is not about something you can medicate, right? It's about a mismatch of communication.
It's an environment again.
Environment,
yeah.
needs, mm-hmm. you know, all those things. And so if we are medicalizing this too much, then we're going to miss all of the other ways that we could adapt and change our systems to make them a place where neurodivergent folks can thrive. Sorry.
Yeah.
These are concerns that I have.
Mm-hmm.
That some of those changes that we were talking about, like different ways of approaching the classrooms, different mm-hmm. ways of understanding our colleagues, mm-hmm. all of those are things that happen outside of policy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if we change and adapt the way that we interact with one another, and, you know, it's a fundamental thing, but sort of approach each other with grace and curiosity.
Yep.
Instead of being so quick to assign mm-hmm. ill intent, mm-hmm. then maybe we don't need to rely as much on those federal policies that mm-hmm. really are inadequate anyway. The accommodations process, you know, we could do a whole podcast on how that
does. Of course. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so why not just try to make our classrooms better? And mm-hmm. that affects everybody, you know, benefits everybody. And it's not
including us.
Right. And definitely
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
And it makes it more fun to teach. Let's be
absolutely
be real.
Absolutely,
you know,
it does.
More relational. You really get mm-hmm. to know your students well, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And we don't need to have that dictated by the federal government.
Exactly. Jennifer Greenfield, thank you very much for joining us. It was extraordinarily helpful.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted that you're taking on this topic, and I really appreciate the time to talk with you.
Thanks again to Jennifer Greenfield for taking the time to talk with us today. The In Social Work podcast team is comprised of the diverse skills and personalities possessed by Steve Sturman, our tech and web guru, Ryan Trof, our GA production assistant, guest coordinator, and content contributor. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And me, Peter Sabota. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time, everybody.